Good evening. It is a distinct pleasure for us to be back in Clarksville and worshiping here with the brethren at Warfield Boulevard. We have fond memories of those years we spent here and the relationships that we developed, and it's good to see familiar faces. It's also good to see new faces and friends from other places. You've come to hear the gospel preached, and you might think, well, we're delving into the minor prophets. How does that connect with the gospel? Because it's the Old Testament, and, you know, we are citizens of God's kingdom in the New Testament. But the book of God is a harmonious whole. It tells the story of salvation that begins in the mind of God before the making of the world, before the foundation of the world. God had a plan that was unfolded over time, and that dealt with the need to which Brother Paul alluded, the fact that we all have sinned, as did Adam and Eve. And to solve that problem, God determined to send His Son. And so God worked out that plan through history, and that involved a chosen people, and it involved the events that we read of in the Old Testament, all of which anticipate and build toward the coming of Jesus Christ and the gospel of Christ. And so we're going to be looking tonight at Obadiah. That's one of the minor prophets, and as we say that, you might think, well, minor equals insignificant. No, minor equals short. That's all that means, is because when you look in the prophets, you're dealing with a section of Old Testament scriptures. Often the Old Testament is divided into three sections: history, poetry, and prophecy. And so the history, of course, deals with the creation onward, to Israel being carried away captive and then brought back to the land, and then silence falls, divine revelation ceases until the coming of John the Baptist and of Jesus Christ. The poetic books fit into that history at different places with the life of David or Solomon or Job, and prophets do the same. And so they are interspersed in the unfolding of God's history. And so Obadiah is one of those prophets that spoke to the circumstances of God's people. So we've entitled this series of lessons, and when I first was asked about this, I thought, wow, this is a challenge to do a gospel meeting on half of the minor prophets. I'm really thankful for the challenge. It proved to be a very interesting task of how do you create a set of lessons that have cohesiveness, that hold together, as somewhat of a theme for the entire meeting, that are able to address it in basically 45 minutes, there, give or take. Hopefully not taking too much more of your time than that, but we'll do what we can in the time that we have to look at these books. This evening, we have a book with one chapter, so you would think that would be easy. This would be the shortest. Not necessarily so. So we'll do what we can in as efficient a way as possible. But as we look at the people of God in the book of Obadiah, we are focusing on that theme, the people of God. Because in the book of Obadiah, the people of God are under assault, and or at least they have been subject to mistreatment by their enemies. And sadly, their enemies are their kinfolk. Their enemies share a common heritage, which sometimes is where the deepest level of animosity comes from. Sadly, fights within families can sometimes be very painful, more so than, say, a disagreement with a distant neighbor or a person we hardly know. But as we think of this book, first of all, the author, Obadiah. Well, who is Obadiah? As was the case with many characters in the Old Testament and authors of books, their names had some significance, and his name means servant of Jehovah. There's about a dozen men in the Old Testament named Obadiah. I don't know that we can connect them, any one of them in particular, with any confidence to the author of this book. So whether they are or not, I think is highly doubtful, but we don't know anything about the author of this book other than perhaps a connection that might be made, but I think is tenuous and very uncertain at that. But as we would think of the date, again, we just don't know when to date this book. Many would place it early, and I think there are some strong arguments that could be made early in the Israelite history after the divided kingdom. As you recall, to give a context for that statement, Israel left Egypt, led by Moses through the wilderness, entered the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua, conquered the land, and enjoyed a period of relative faithfulness and security during the days of Joshua and the elders, and then fell into disobedience, or at least a cycle of disobedience in the time of the judges. When they were faithful, God blessed them. When they fell away, God basically withheld his hand of protection, and they were overrun by their enemies. Eventually, Israel cried out for a king, and so God gave them Saul, and then David, and then Solomon, and the Israelites were united, all 12 tribes united under the monarchy. But that split apart after the death of Solomon. And so you have the division of Israel into the northern 10 tribes and the southern tribe of Judah. And it's during that period of time that followed that these, quote, minor prophets fall. But as far as dating the book of Obadiah, it really centers around the main event that's discussed in the book, and that is when the Edomites, kinfolk of Israel, showed hostility and acted in violence and in a predatory fashion against their own distant relatives. And so there were four times when Israel was invaded, when Jerusalem was invaded, let me correct, and when potentially Edom could have been involved. And so in these four times, the city of Jerusalem was subjected to invasion, in which they were often overrun. The treasures that were stored up in the house of God were taken, captured by the attacking king or his army, and so they were plundered during the days of Shishak, during the time of the Philistine and the Arabian assault, during the time when King Joash of Israel assaulted Israel, and then finally when Nebuchadnezzar led the Babylonian forces against Judah, and they were carried away captive into Babylon. So you have all of those events, and we could spend all of our time reading those references, but those are events that could generally fit the circumstances the book alludes to, and in which this story could have arisen because of the way that the Edomites acted. Whatever date that we assign to the book, and I'm just going to leave that question unanswered, because while I might have an opinion, it really is not something that can be definitively defended. And so, recognizing there are several possibilities, what we do see in this time frame is the neighboring nation of Edom. They were kin, distant relatives of the Israelites. They sided against Jerusalem in the time of their distress. And even though they dwelt in what they viewed as an impregnable mountain fortress, a fortress that could not be defeated because it was so securely set in a place in which the enemies could not bring them down, nevertheless, God could. And the sad fact of Edom is that they represent a fairly general human tendency that we all can fall into, and that is being proud and also sometimes acting in a perverse way toward our brethren, acting in a hateful or malicious way toward our brethren. And so the lessons from this obscure book are very real and meaningful to us. They are very present because human nature hadn't changed. You know, and even Paul in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4 reminds us the things that were written before time were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. God is faithful. God protects his own. God is there for us to lean upon, but he expects us to be faithful to him. And so the story of the Old Testament is the story of human failure and sometimes faithfulness, and the consequences of those alternative approaches. The background, I think, helps us understand this book better. The Obadiah pronounces judgment against a people called the Edomites. They were the nation of Edom. They were the enemies of Israel. They were really fierce adversaries of Israel, and they were kinfolk. This was Hatfields and McCoys, and they were all the same blood. They all came from the same basic family tree. And so Esau, you remember, the son of Isaac, the brother of Jacob. Esau is the progenitor, the father of this nation. He was the one from whom they came. And if you read in the book of Genesis, and it's very interesting, the interaction between these two brothers, very different personalities, and they didn't get along. And they ended up being enemies. At least that was sort of the defining characteristic of much of their existence. There were some times of reconciliation, but that really didn't last. And so you can read of the story of Jacob and Esau in Genesis 25 through 36. But again, our time doesn't permit us to delve into that. But it does serve as a background. But one thing that was said when the children were still in their mother's womb, when Rebecca was still with children, and she has twins, and they're quite active inside the womb, as babies can sometimes be during pregnancy. They're struggling with each other, and God took that moment to reveal to her, two nations are in your womb. And I facetiously could almost say, well, yep, and they're already at war. That's probably how she felt in the way in which these two twin boys were moving about and making her uncomfortable. But two nations are in your womb, and the elder shall serve the younger. Well, as you know, if you're familiar with the Bible, Esau came out first. The twins were born rapidly, one after the other. Esau issued forth first, but as he came forth, his brother's hand was holding on to his heel. Jacob's hand was holding on to the heel of Esau. So one was older by a matter of seconds, probably, as far as birth went, but that gave him the right of priority in the ancient world. And he was the firstborn, and with that comes the position of, you know, inheriting the leadership of the family. Jacob, the heel catcher, the one who came forth grasping, had sort of a personality that matched that. And so he was manipulative. And so he sort of ran circles around his big, dumb older brother and manipulated him out of his birthright and ultimately out of the blessing. He was conniving. He was devious. There's not good that can be said about the way in which he behaved himself at that point in time. He was not relying on God's promises. He was relying upon his own wit and his own cunning. And he only eventually later learns to trust in God rather than his own ingenuity and craftiness. But two nations. So you have the beginnings of two different distinct peoples. And so subsequently, these brothers and the nations who developed from them, they lived in different regions of the land of basically the Bible lands. The Israelites were given the land of Canaan, the land we associate with the nation of Israel. The Edomites lived off to the south and the east, on the far side of the Dead Sea, down toward the desert, and so that was where Edom dwelt. And so we see that they went their separate ways, but the statement that's made here in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 6 warns us that we should not come short of the grace of God. Turn and read with me Hebrews 12:15 through 17. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, and that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble. So bitterness, which is going to be the theme of this lesson, the problem of Edom toward Israel, began to be manifested by Esau toward Isaac, or toward his brother Jacob, excuse me. And so with that bitter spirit comes alienation, and by which many are defiled. And not only that, Esau, perhaps less than his descendants, but to a certain degree he demonstrates this by his own foolish choices, was an immoral and godless person, and he showed his lack of having a true value system by selling his birthright for a bowl of red meat. And so here he sold his birthright for a single meal. And even though afterwards he wished that it would have been different, when the consequences of that finally sunk in, God, the pronouncement once made could not be revoked. And so God, and neither his father who pronounced the blessing, nor God from whom the blessing came, could alter it once it had been given. So Esau is a profane man. an irreligious man, a man who does not value things of enduring value. Key concept there. Now, God's estimate of these two nations is summed up in a statement that's found in Romans. Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. Bear in mind, this wasn't stated to their mother when they were babes in the womb, or necessarily even in reference to their life as they were in the home of their parents or subsequently thereafter. Quotation comes from Malachi, the very last book in the Old Testament, the last of the minor prophets, referring not to the sons per se, but to the nations from who came from them. And so God chose Jacob and Israel as the vehicle through whom his promises would come. God did not choose Esau as that means by which Jesus would enter the world. And so there was a relative preference of one over another. Love and hatred can sometimes be simply relative preference. You know, we are to love God, and then in comparison to that, you know, Jesus sometimes even spoke about our attitude toward our parents. If a man does not hate his father or mother, he cannot be my disciple. Well, he's not cultivating or encouraging malice or any ill spirit. But what he's saying is, in a relative value system, you've got to love me more than you love anybody else. And you've got to follow me before anybody else. And so it's love more versus love less in that context. I think that plays into it here, but I think also the differing characteristics of the two peoples. Israel's faithfulness to God was spotty. It wasn't always consistent. They suffered because of that, but they were God's chosen people. And there were times when they were faithful and when they showed resolve. The Edomites never. The Edomites never had that attitude. So as a result, two were friends of God, and the Israelites were friends of God, and the others were not. And so this is not speaking of individuals, but the nations, and the fact that the Edomites, and I want you to look at least Psalms 137, and we can forego the Ezekiel passage for the sake of time, but you can see in Psalms 137 how that the Edomites aligned themselves, probably not once, but multiple times, with Israel's enemies. This is a pronouncement of judgment. Psalms 137 and verses 7 and 8. And where the psalmist is asking God to remember and to recompense. Vengeance is mine, I shall repay, saith the Lord. And so God is the one that can set things right when man is powerless to do so. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, when the Edomites said, raise it to the very foundation. And notice the spelling. It's not R-A-I-S-E, it's not raise it up, it's tear it down. It's obliterate it. It's tear it to its foundations, destroy it and sow it with salt so that nothing else will be there in the afterwards. So basically the Edomites were hoping that the Babylonians, and they were the ones that carried away Judah into captivity, they were hoping that Babylon would utterly destroy their hated enemy, their own kinfolk. And so, notice how the response of the psalmist is in verse 8. How blessed is the one who repays you with the recompense with which you've repaid us. So it's that kind of really in generational deep-seated hostility that gives us a background for the understanding of why God would speak as he does concerning Edom. We're dealing with the problem of enduring enmity, or simply stated, deep-seated hatred. And so when it comes to the people of God, how many times over the course of Israel's history did Edom give Israel a hard time? In one way or another, either overtly in military attack or simply in being obstinate and difficult. Israel wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. At the end of that time, Moses sought to lead them through the land of Edom. He made it very clear, we are not going to take anything without paying for it. We are not going to do any damage. We are going to be very careful. We respect you as our relatives, though distant. We're going to be respectful toward you and your property, your flocks and your herds. The king of Edom wouldn't allow it, so they had to pass by through the eastern desert. They refused passage. That's one example. Later, when they come to the plains of Moab, and when the prophet for hire enters the story, and he pronounces blessings on Israel instead of curses, one of the things that Balaam prophesied was that Judah or Israel would possess Edom. So the prophecy of God's people ultimately prevailing was given in Numbers 24. During the days of Saul, they fought against the Edomites. Some served in his armies. During the days of David, same thing is basically true. He conquered Edom and also surrounding countries. During the days of Solomon, it was obviously a part of his area in which he had control, because he restored the port city that lay at the southern tip of Edom. That was the port that led to the riches of the east. And he also constructed a place in which copper could be smelted and processed. And so among the great accomplishments of Solomon, they took place under the controlled territory of Edom. During the divided kingdom, there's hostility. Sometimes power shifts back and forth between the two groups. Israel sometimes being dominant, Edom sometimes gaining their independence and being an active force of hostility. So it's an unsettled state. And then after the downfall of Jerusalem, when they are carried away captive and are in Babylon for 70 years, then the Edomites fill the vacuum. They settle in the land of Judah in the southern part. Then we come down to the Nabataeans. They would be the successors to the Edomites, or at least the name associated with the people who dwelt there that continued to inhabit that region. If you remember the movie Indiana Jones, you know, and the search for the Cup of Christ, I forget which one that was named, but in that series of, you know, stories that Harrison Ford started in way back in another lifetime, almost it seemed like, the picturesque location where the final climactic scenes of that particular movie occurred was in Petra. It was in this same very beautiful but very rugged region. Later, they are conquered by some of the Jewish patriots in the time between the Testaments, and the last remnant of the Edomites would be found in the family of Herod. They were Idumeans, which was what the descendants of Edom were then called, and then they disappear into the pages of history. They cease to be. Key ideas. So that's history. Key ideas. In Genesis 12 and verses 1 through 3, God made a promise on which the entire rest of Scripture can be understood as sort of a pivot point or a key passage that that everything else hangs on in its fulfillment. He called Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees. He promised, "I will make of thee a great nation. I'll give thee the land of Canaan. Through thy seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed." And so in the context of that, he also says, "I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those that curse you." So God promised to bless Abraham and his descendants, and he also promise that if there were opponents of the people of God through whom his purpose was being unfolded, that they would also likewise fall under God's wrath. Now, sometimes Israel, because of their unfaithfulness, didn't have God as their protector because they were rebellious. And so he withdrew his hand of sovereign protection and they were overrun by their enemies. But when they were faithful, they had that assurance and that promise. So getting to the book. It took us that long to get to the book. Five sections in the book of Obadiah. One chapter, five different distinct themes. First of all, verses 1 through 4, and we'll come back through each of these in a moment. God stands in judgment upon Edom because Edom, the nation, the people, are proud and cruel. Verses 5 through 9, when he is judged by God, it will be complete and final. Verses 10 through 14, they focus in particular on what he means by cruelty, how he was cruel toward his kinsman Jacob. And now, Edom, verses 15 and 16, like all the nations, face the judgment of God, and they will reap as they have sown, and yet in a book of judgment. And what's amazing, as we'll study together over the course of these next six lessons, including tonight, though some of these books you know, are fearful in their pronouncement of judgment, there is always that silver lining. There is always that ray of sunshine, that through the clouds of judgment, the promise of God is offered. And that gives Israel encouragement that even though they are temporarily suffering under God's temporal judgments, that if they will repent and return, things will change and His blessings will replace chastening. But it's also a promise that this is looking forward beyond the struggles that the book focuses on to the coming of one through whom reconciliation and broken relationships can be restored. And that's Jesus Christ. So, divine judgment. Let's get on into the book and in the time that we have left. Let's see what we can do in understanding the text. So, in verses 1 through 4, read with me. And I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, the 1995 edition. The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, Arise and let us go against her for battle. Behold, this is God's determination toward one who viewed himself, Edom viewed himself as powerful and beyond attack, beyond assault, inassailable. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. And you, in fact, are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling places, and say in your heart, who will bring me down to the earth? They had a fortress. They had multiple fortresses, powerfully defended because of their strategic locations. They could not be assaulted by normal armies of the day. And they felt like that no one could bring them down. Who will bring me down? Notice the word of God through the prophet. Though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, saith the Lord. So when men choose to rebel against God and choose to oppose the purpose of God and the people of God, who, let's hope, are doing the will of God, they bring upon themselves divine judgment. So God says, I'm going to bring you down. Man may not be able to. The enemies of Edom may have been unsuccessful. But God is not so limited. A complete outpouring of divine wrath is prophesied in verses 4, 5 through 9. And so Edom's destruction will be complete and final. Notice the questions that are posed. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, now you can leave aside the parenthetical phrase, would they not steal until they had enough? Would they take everything is the question. But notice God interjects something in the midst of this. If thieves came to you and robbers by night, normally they're going to leave something behind, but oh, how you will be ruined. They're going to do far worse than normally would be expected. If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? For those of us that may not be familiar with ancient agricultural practices, mandated by God, by the way, is that when they harvested fields or the grapes, the vineyards, they always were to leave something behind. The corners of the field were not to be completely cut down and gathered up into sheaves, nor every grape off of the grapevine for the poor of the land. So it was a means. It was God's safety net for his fellow Israelites and the poor. So whenever they harvested the grain, there was something left behind when the grapes were gathered. There were still grapes hanging in clusters, though depleted compared to, you know, the richness of the harvest. But oh, how Esau will be ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. So when the enemies of Egypt, or when the enemies of Edom come, they're going to take it all. They're not leaving anything behind. The men allied with you will send you forth to the border. In other words, your allies will turn on you. And the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. And so you will be betrayed as you have betrayed others. and they will eat your bread and set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him. Now, one of the things about the Edomites is they prided themselves in their understanding. But here, ultimately, though they possessed what men call wisdom, because they were rebellious to the will of God and opposed the purpose of God, they had no understanding. If folks today who seem to have wisdom oppose the will of God and the purpose of God, they are not as wise as they present themselves to be, nor should we regard them as such. They have no understanding either. Again, destroy the wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Israel. I will do that on that day, declares the Lord. And then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, so that they may all, every one, be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. So God's judgment, complete, on the, basically, the strength that Edom possessed in its wisdom, in its mighty fortresses, in its wealth. They controlled the trade routes. We mentioned Zion, Geber, and Egypt. Trade that came north from the Red Sea, or even from Egypt, if it went on the eastern route, had to pass through the region of Edom, and they got their cut. They were wealthy because they controlled the trade routes. They were powerful because they had a mighty mountain fortress. They thought themselves wise. And some of the counselors that came to talk to Job and offered wisdom, what they thought was wisdom, wasn't good advice, really, when you get down to it, but it was viewed in their day and time as epitomizing wisdom. They came from Edom, or from that same region. Callousness. You know what a callous is? You know, when you work hard, you develop calluses. And that means basically you're sort of toughened up where you don't feel, if going barefoot. Daniel and siblings and I, we used to, when we were kids, ran around barefoot all the time. It kills me to walk on rocks today, barefoot. I've got to have shoes on if I go outside on anything that's hard, because I just don't have calluses on my feet. Now, I run a lot, but I run with shoes on. I don't run barefoot. Calluses basically means you've developed a level of insensitivity. That's good for work. Good to have calluses. Young men, it's good to develop calluses. But it's not good to have a calloused heart. It's not good to be unfeeling. And so that's really what we're talking about here, is the callousness of Edom toward Israel, or toward Jacob. 10 through 14. Because of the violence toward your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame and cut off forever. Notice how that violence was expressed. There was a time when Israel was assaulted, whether it was the Babylonians, if it was late, or one of those earlier invasions that we referred to earlier. Same principle would apply. On the day that Israel, when Judah, when Jerusalem was threatened, instead of coming to the aid of your brethren, instead of responding to their need and helping them in their distress, you stood aloof. You just sort of stood back and watched and smirked as they were overwhelmed and overrun and as they were looted and carried away captive. And so when foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, when they were victorious and they were fighting over the spoils of their conquest, you too were as one of them. And if nothing that they did, if they did nothing worse than that, their inaction equal action. In other words, think about this. If we don't stand up for Christ when we ought to stand up, we're no better than the world. We're no different than the world. In fact, in some ways, we're worse because we know better. But if you don't stand up when you're supposed to, when you need to, we basically have cast our lot with the enemy, the spiritual enemy. Don't gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Don't rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. So boasting at the calamity of another, be careful about that. And certainly in the context of a brother. Don't enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Again, do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. Do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. So you see, it's progressively getting worse. They're not just standing back looking, they're gloating. They're delighted. that their brethren, the Israelites, their hated brethren, the Israelites, are getting what they deserve. That's their attitude. Keep it coming, whoever the enemy might be. And then it says, don't stand at the fork of the road and cut down the fugitives or imprison the survivors on the day of their distress. You see, they actually became physical enemies. They slew their own brethren, their own kinsmen, their own relatives. As the fugitives were fleeing, had escaped the assault by the enemy, guess who killed them before they could get to safety? Who cut them down? Who imprisoned them? It was Edom. So that is brothers against brothers. This is kinfolk against kinfolk. That is callousness. There is no compassion seen here. So what we see as we conclude our study, verses 15 and 16, is the inevitable promise, or the purpose of God, is that we reap as we sow. If we sow to the wind, we're going to reap the whirlwind. That's another statement that comes from the prophets that's relevant to us today and applicable to us today. But it says, the day of the Lord draws near for all the nations. Now, I want to pause, and we're going to be seeing that phrase, day of the Lord, several times over the course of our studies, over the next, through the weekend. And the term can refer to different events in the use of it in the Bible. Usually in the Old Testament, it refers to a point of temporal judgment, a day of calamitous judgment on Israel or their enemies, and so it has to do with the judgment in time and place. And then when we come to the New Testament, there is a sense in which the day of the Lord may have a far-reaching effect, the final day. But that's not what's under consideration here. What's under consideration here are the temporal judgments that God brought upon His people and the enemies of God's people, sometimes used by God to chastise God's people, but then subject themselves to divine justice. The day of the Lord draws near upon all the nations. And so God holds men accountable in time and in eternity. As you have done, it will be done to you. Now there is a lesson to underline and highlight and remember. It applies to us with equal force and power as it did to them. As we do, it shall be done to us. Now, we should heed the words of Jesus, who gave, you know, the positive application of this. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the golden rule. It is a positive expression of what God wants us to do. And if that be the case, then blessings will be the result. But if we choose a life of rebellion, we can't escape the consequences. And that's true for young folks, and that's true for middle-aged folks, and that's true for gray-haired folks. It's true for us all. Your dealings will be returned upon your own head, because just as you drank on my holy mountain, as you gleefully exploited and participated in the destruction of my people, and it was party time, you know, you were excited and delighted that Israel, or that Jerusalem, Judah suffered the chastisement of their enemies. The nations will drink continually of you. And they will drink and swallow and become as they never existed. It's a little hard to discern who's going to disappear from history. Well, all of them did. You know, all of the characters of that age, all of the participants of that age, Edom, you know, and Moab and Ammon and, you know, the Philistines, none of those people survive until today. But the Jewish people were promised that they would endure. That was a distinction there. Now, the last thought is in the final few verses. I'm sorry, I didn't get my screen far enough ahead, so divine deliverance. Divine deliverance is the last thought. Verses 17 through 20. The positive application of this: the prophets will often, as they look beyond the present and look to the future, anticipate a time when things are better. And they'll do so in some ways where it does connect with Old Testament history. but quite often looks beyond Old Testament history to the coming of Jesus Christ. And so I see some of both of that here. Escape from God's judgment will only be found on Mount Zion. And it will come about, I believe this text is teaching, through the seed of Abraham, which is Jesus Christ, not to seeds as of many, said Paul, but through thy seed, through one seed, that is Jesus, who will possess his enemies. It says, on Mount Zion, and remember Isaiah 2 and Micah chapter 4, which we'll talk about, I think, Sunday night, God's mountain. It talks about the mountain of the Lord from which the law of the Lord will echo forth. That occurs in Acts chapter 2. On Mount Zion will be those that escape. It will be holy. The house of Jacob will possess their possessions. The house of Jacob will be a fire. The house of Joseph a flame. So here God's people, Jacob, Joseph, of course, the father of two of the largest of the tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. So here it's speaking to the people of God in their entirety. They will be a consuming fire. And they will set them on fire and consume them. That is, the enemies of God, at least in a symbolic sense. They will prevail while the enemies of God will be vanquished. So that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau. For the Lord has spoken. And then those of the Negev, the southland of Israel, will possess the mountains of Esau. So the Israelites will be in a dominant position and defeat their enemies to the east. And those of the Shephelah, the Philistine plain, they will defeat the Philistines who occupied the western coastlands that bordered the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. They will possess the territory of Ephraim. They will occupy the territory to the north and central part of the land. And that of Samaria, it's already been carried away into captivity probably. And Benjamin will possess Gilead. They will possess the regions east of the Jordan. And the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel, among the Canaanites, as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad, people from afar, the dispersion, will possess the cities of the Negev. They will be brought back and a part of God's blessings. And deliverers will ascend Mount Zion, and they will judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. And so in this, you have physical imagery. Physical imagery that I'm afraid probably the Jews literalized a little too much. Because when they thought about the coming Christ, what was their concept of the Messiah? Well, he's going to restore us to the land. He's going to restore us to political independence. He's going to restore us to national glory. And so when Jesus came to be a king, and he said, my kingdom's not of this world, they just sort of marked him off the list. That wasn't who they were wanting, because their preconceptions were so rooted in literalizing promises like this that they missed the spiritual application, which was, yes, some of this occurs as Israel's history unfolds, and they ultimately overcome the adversity of captivity. They are restored to the land. They endure the difficulties in the Maccabean period. They prevail over the Greeks' effort to make everybody little Greeks. The Hellenization process of the Greeks did not work with Israel because they resisted in the days of the Maccabees, and they maintained their commitment to God. And so in some senses, yes, they were prevalent over their physical enemies. But I don't think that's really what this is saying. I think it's saying that God's purposes, expressed way back in Genesis, I give you the land of Canaan, I'll make of you a great nation, those were means to an end of the third and the great and the ultimate promise that through thy seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So, that brings us to our invitation. And as we think about the hostility of the people of God, directed toward the people of God, as I think of that, I'm reminded of what Jesus told his disciples. On the night of his betrayal, Jesus reminded his disciples that the world's going to hate you. And the reason it hates you is because it hated me. And the reason it hates me is because it hates the one who sent me. So if we live in a world And here's, I think, the takeaway lesson from tonight. The people of God in every age have been an unpopular minority. And sometimes an extremely unpopular minority. And you look at the course of our nation and the direction it is taking. And while it one time seemed that we lived in a Judeo-Christian culture, no more. We live in a very hostile environment that is becoming more so with each passing day. If the attitudes of the progressive woke movement take hold, we're facing hard times. I don't know that they will. We don't know how the ebbs and the flows of history unfold, and it may be that it's reached its high water mark and it's going to self-destruct. You can hope. But let's say it doesn't. Let's say things get worse and we face overt, actual hostility. We're no different than Edom. But God came to the defense. We're no different from Israel who suffered under the hands of Edom. Let me say it like that. But God came to the defense of His people and He delivered them from their oppressors. And God will always, always come to the defense of His faithful remnant. So it really doesn't matter how the world responds, and nor should we allow the attitude of the world to become our attitude. It's very tempting to respond to the kind of overt hostility that led to the tragedy in Nashville, if reports indicate the motivation behind the killer. It had to do with the issues that are involving culture right now and a hatred toward Christianity that is resistant to those trends toward LGBTQ activity. But that being the case, if it turns into overt hostility, we should not respond in the same way. Jesus said, love your enemies. And we can seek to win people who may be confused and who may be deluded and who may be filled with animosity. As Paul said, you win the battle not by returning evil for evil or railing for railing, but you win the battle by responding to mistreatment with the principle of Jesus Christ. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those that rejoice and weep with those that weep. And be of the same mind one toward another. Don't be like Edom toward brethren. Let's not let alienation pull us apart. Let's stand firm in one faith, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Do not be wise in your own estimation. Again, don't be like Edom. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. This is Paul speaking. Romans 12, by the way. And as much as it depends upon you, if it's possible, live at peace with all men. Do not take your own revenge, but leave room for the wrath of God, because it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. And so if your enemy hungers, feed him, and if he thirsts, give him drink. In so doing, you will heap coals of burning fire, or burning coals upon his head. Don't be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. And so, that's the way Christians should respond to an environment that's hostile, by seeking to share with others, even those seriously deluded and confused, the truth of the gospel. Don't change the gospel to accommodate the corruption of the present era. Preach it in its purity, simplicity, with love and compassion, trying to help those who may hate, and maybe there's a soul that can be saved in all of that. So this evening, the invitation, 8:45, is that correct? Are you coming to Jesus tonight? That's the question all of us need to face. And so if you're not yet a Christian, the gospel invitation is yours. We would encourage you to be obedient to the gospel of Christ, hearing, believing, repenting, confessing, being baptized, being faithful. If we can assist you in that, come as we stand and as we sing. I'll be happy to entertain any. I don't know that I'll have answers that will be sufficient, but I'll be happy to entertain. It's very good to have question and answer sessions in the Philippines when we go there. That is often what follows maybe 2 or 3, 4 hours worth of teaching, and then it lasts for 2 or 3 hours. I don't really expect that tonight, but it's sometimes where the best good is done. So was there anything confusing or needs clarification that was said or any comments that you might have to share? Yes, sir. Yeah, you have Joseph, who rose to, you know, he was not the absolute youngest. You know, Benjamin, of course, came later, but he was the baby that became the one to whom all the other brothers answered when they went down to Egypt for provision and led Israel during that time when they were in Egypt, or at least leading up as they entered into Egypt. Same thing with Jacob and Esau. Are there other examples that come to mind? Those are the two that immediately come to mind. Chris, do you recall any others? But it is significant that the normal order of firstborn being the one of primacy is sometimes shifted, except with Jesus Christ. He is firstborn of all creation. Of course, firstborn from the dead in the sense that he was resurrected directly by the power of God without human intervention. But he is our absolute sovereign. Yes, brother.
Benjamin was the youngest,
right,
but he became the first king of Israel.
That the Saul came from the tribe of Benjamin, and so there again, supremacy through the youngest of the 12 sons. Exactly. Another parallel. Paul, do you have anything to add or offer? Yes, you know. Yeah. And you know, even the prophet was confused. You know, look at these big boys, you know, that Jesse has. You know, Eliab, wasn't that one of the names of one of them? Isn't he the one that you intend? Well, no, it's the one out in the field that doesn't even rank to be involved in this august proceeding. So God choosing David. Anything else? As the week goes on, you know, tomorrow night, is it Jonah or Joel?
Joel.
So Joel, you know, we look at Joel as an example of God's wrath, but also of God's mercy. And Joel is so amazing to me because Acts 2, what does Peter say in the book, in his sermon on the day of Pentecost, that the events that occurred in Acts 2, this is what Joel was talking about. So while Joel is a book of judgment, and dark judgment at that, there's still that glimmer of hope revealed and seen on the day of Pentecost. So come back if you have the chance.